Moralia, quaestiones convivials. Hating a mindful drinking companion, saucius senescio, some say this proverb was originally said of billeted soldiers, who are fairly boorish and ill-mannered when they drink. For the Dorians of Sicily, it seems, called a billeted lodger a mnamon, a rememberer. Others think the proverb enjoins amnesty for what is said and done over wine. That is why our ancestral traditions consecrate both forgetfulness and the fennel stalk to the god, on the ground that either nothing that goes wrong under the influence of wine deserves to be remembered, or that it deserves only a light, childlike admonition, at most. But since you too think that forgetting what is out of place is, as Euripides truly says, wise, whereas altogether failing to remember what happens over wine not only conflicts with the table's reputation for fostering friendship, but also has against it the testimony of the most distinguished philosophers, Plato, Xenophon, Aristotle, Speusippus, Epicurus, Prytanes, Hieronymus, and Dio of the Academy. Men who thought it a task worthy of some effort to record conversations that took place over wine. And since you thought we ought to gather together what is useful from the discussions scattered often, now in Rome with you, now among us in Greece, when table and cup were both present and literary talk went on, with this in view, I have already sent you 3 of the books, each containing 10 questions, and I shall send the rest quickly too, if these seem not entirely lacking in taste or unfit for the god of wine. First of all is placed the question of philosophizing over wine. For you remember that, when a debate arose at Athens after dinner as to whether philosophical talk should be used over wine, and to what measure, if it is used, Ariston, who was present, said, "Are there really people, in the god's name, who refuse philosophy a place at wine?" And I said, "But indeed there are, my friend, people who, putting on a very solemn, ironic air, say that philosophy, like a proper mistress of the house, ought not to raise her voice over wine, and that the Persians are right not to get drunk and dance with their wedded wives, but with their concubines instead. In just the same way, they think we ought to bring music and play acting into our drinking parties, but not stir up philosophy, on the ground that she is not suited to playing along, nor are we, at such a time, disposed to be serious. They point out that even Isocrates the sophist, when pressed to say something over wine, could not bring himself to do more than this. In the things I am skilled at, this is not the occasion, and in the things suited to this occasion, I am not skilled." And Cato cried out and said, "Well said, by Dionysus." He swore off the discussion, since it was going to run through such periods as would have thrown the party of the Graces into an uproar. Yet I do not think it is the same thing to banish a rhetorical speech from a symposium and to banish a philosophical one. Philosophies is a different kind of discourse, one which, being concerned with living, is not likely to hold itself aloof from any occasion of play or any pastime of pleasure, but to be present in all things, bringing with it measure and timeliness. Or else we must suppose that neither temperance nor justice ought to be admitted into our drinking either, mocking their dignity with irony. Now if, like those who entertained Orestes, we were going to eat and drink in silence in the Thesmothetaean, that would be no unfortunate consolation for our ignorance. But if Dionysus is, in all respects, Lysias and Laius, the looser and the releaser, and above all he removes the bit from the tongue and gives the voice the greatest freedom, then I think it foolish and senseless, when the occasion for talk abounds, to deprive it of the best kind of talk, to inquire in our lecture rooms into the duties proper to a fellow drinker and what makes a good table companion and how wine should be used, and yet to banish philosophy from the actual drinking parties themselves, as though it were unable to confirm in practice what it teaches in theory. And when you said it was not worth arguing further with Cato about these matters, but that some boundary and character should be sought for the kind of philosophizing proper at wine, escaping this very charge, playfully, and not without wit, leveled against wranglers and would-be sophists, you said, "But now, let us go to dinner so that we may join in the fray of Ares, as Homer says," and you called us on to the discussion. I said first that I thought we should consider who is present. If the party has a good many literary people in it, like the Socrateses, Phaedruses, Pausaniuses, and Eryximachuses at Agathon's table, or the Charmideses, Antisthenes, and Hermogeneses at Callias's, and others like them, we shall let them philosophize as they please, no less mixing Dionysus with the muses than with the nymphs. For the nymphs make him gracious and gentle for the body, but the muses truly gentle and gift-giving for the soul. And even if a few ordinary people are present, they will, like mute letters set among the vowels of a crowd of educated men, share in some utterance that is not wholly inarticulate, and in some understanding. But if there should be a great number of people of the sort who put up with the sound of any bird, any bowstring, or any piece of wood sooner than the voice of a philosopher, then Pisistratus's expedient is useful. When he had a quarrel with his sons, and perceived that his enemies were rejoicing at it, he called an assembly, and said that he himself wished to persuade his sons. But since they were being stubborn, he would himself yield to them and follow their wishes. In just this way, a philosophical man, among drinking companions who will not accept his kind of talk, will change his tune, fall in with them, and be content with their entertainment, so long as it does not overstep propriety. Knowing that men engage in rhetoric through speech, but philosophize even while keeping silent, and playing, and, by Zeus, even while being mocked and mocking in turn. For it is not only, as Plato says, the height of injustice to seem just without being so, but it is also the height of good sense to philosophize without seeming to philosophize, and while playing, to accomplish what serious people accomplish. For just as Euripides's Maenads, unarmed and without weapons of iron, wound their assailants merely with their light thyrsus wands, so too the jests and laughter of true philosophers move and turn about, in some fashion, even those who are not entirely invulnerable. I think, too, that there is a certain kind of narrative fit for a drinking party, some of which history supplies and some of which can be drawn from matters close at hand, containing many examples useful for philosophy and many for piety, some inducing emulation of brave and high-minded deeds, others of kind and humane ones. If someone uses these unobtrusively to guide the drinkers along, he will remove no small part of the evils of drunkenness. Now those who mix borage into the wine and sprinkle the floor with infusions of vervain and maidenhair fern, thinking that these things instill cheerfulness and friendliness in their guests, imitating the Homeric Helen who drugged the unmixed wine, fail to notice that even that myth, after making its long way round from Egypt, ends up meaning nothing more than fitting and becoming conversation. For Helen, as they are drinking, tells them about Odysseus. Such a deed that steadfast man endured and performed, subduing his very self with shameful blows. For this, it seems, was the drug that banished grief and pain. A story with a timeliness suited to the feelings and circumstances at hand. And people of taste, even when they philosophize directly, at such a time lead their discourse through what is persuasive rather than through the compulsion of formal proofs. For you see that even Plato, in the Symposium, when discussing the end of life and the first good and theology in general, does not strain his proof or raise a cloud of dust, making his grip forceful and inescapable as is his usual habit, but instead wins the men over with gentler premises, examples, and myths. And the inquiries themselves ought to be gentler too, and the problems familiar, and the questions reasonable and not petty, so as not to choke the less intelligent or drive them away. For just as it is customary for the bodies of drinkers to be set in motion through dancing and choral movement, but if we force them to get up and fight in armor, or throw the discus, the party will be not only unpleasant but harmful. So too of inquiries into the soul, the light ones stir it fittingly and beneficially. While the kind Democritus calls, contentious and constricting, arguments must be dismissed, since they strain those engaged in them over knotty and hard-to-view matters. And vex the bystanders as well, for talk, like wine, ought to be common property, in which all will share. Those who introduce such problems would show themselves no more accommodating to fellowship than Aesop's crane and fox. The fox poured out a rich broth over a flat stone and offered it to the crane, who was not feasted, but rather made a fool of, for the broth's wateriness eluded the thinness of her mouth. In turn, the crane, inviting her to dinner, set out food for her in a narrow-necked jar, which, having a thin and long neck, allowed her to lower her own mouth easily and enjoy it, but the fox could not get her fair share. So too, then, whenever philosophers, sinking into subtle and dialectical problems over wine, trouble the majority who cannot follow, and those in turn throw themselves into songs and silly stories and vulgar marketplace talk, the whole purpose of table fellowship is lost, and Dionysus is dishonored. Just as, when Phrynichus and Aeschylus advanced tragedy into myths and sufferings, the saying was uttered, "What has this to do with Dionysus?" So it has often occurred to me to say to those who drag the ruling argument into drinking parties, "My good man, what has this to do with Dionysus?" For to sing the so-called scholia, when the mixing bowl is set in the middle and garlands are being handed round, which the god, in freeing us, sets upon our heads, perhaps that is fitting. But the other thing is neither becoming nor suited to a party. Indeed, they say that the scholia are not, in fact, a class of songs composed obscurely, but rather this. First, everyone together sang a hymn to the god with a single voice, as in a paean. Then, second, a myrtle branch was passed on to each in turn, which they called, I think, the eisakos, because whoever received it had to sing. And after that, a lyre was passed around, and the educated man took it and sang in tune, while those without musical skill declined. And so what was not common to all and not easy was called scholion, crooked. Others say that the myrtle did not go around in order, but was carried across from couch to each man individually. The first singer sent it to the first man of the second couch, he to the first man of the third, then the second singer likewise to the second man. And so the crooked, much winding path of its circuit, it seems, is what got the song called scholion. My brother Timon, when giving a feast, used to tell each guest to sit down wherever he wished among those arriving, since both foreigners and citizens, intimates and family members, guests of every sort, in short, were invited. Once, when many guests were already present, a certain stranger got up like some overdressed character out of comedy, with excessive finery and a retinue of slave boys rather affectedly, came as far as the door of the men's dining room, and, casting his eyes around in a circle at those already reclining, refused to go in, but turned and went away. And though many ran after him, he said he saw no place there worthy of himself. The company reclining, laughing heartily, told them to see him off from the house with good wishes, for indeed many of them had already had a fair amount to drink. But when the dinner was over, my father, addressing me as I lay reclining rather far off, said, "Timon, you have made me and yourself judges in a dispute, since I have long had a poor reputation with him on account of that stranger. If the placing of couches had been arranged from the start, as I urged, we would not now be paying the penalty for disorder to a man skilled in marshalling both horses and shield-bearing men. Indeed, they say that the general Paulus Aemilius, when, after defeating Perseus in Macedonia, he was organizing feasts, showed remarkable order in everything and used the same arrangement elsewhere too, and said that it belonged to the same man to draw up a most formidable battle line and to give the most pleasant symposium, for both are matters of good order. And the poet is accustomed to call the best and most kingly men marshallers of the people. And you people, I think, say that the great God changed disorder into order through good arrangement, taking nothing away from what exists and adding nothing, but by setting each thing in its proper place, fashioning the most beautiful shape out of the most formless, working upon nature. But these grander and more solemn matters we learn from you philosophers. We ourselves observe that the expense laid out on dinners has nothing pleasant or generous about it unless it partakes of order. That is why it is absurd that cooks and table servants care intensely about what dish to bring on first, second in the middle, or last. And by Zeus, about the place and arrangement of perfume, garlands, and a harp girl, should one happen to be present. While those invited to enjoy these things are made to recline haphazardly, as it happens, and simply fed, with no regard given to age, office, or anything else of the sort, by which the one who excels is honored. The one who ranks second is trained to accept it, and the host who arranges them is exercised in judgment and in aiming at what is fitting. For it cannot be that there is a fixed seat and standing for the better man, yet no fixed place for reclining, nor that the host pledges one guest before another in the drinking, yet, in the matter of seating arrangements, overlooks the distinctions, revealing from the very start what is called one single mykonos, in effect leveling the whole party. Such, then, was my father's defense. My brother replied that he was no wiser than Bias, so that, whereas Bias had declined to arbitrate between two friends, he himself should become the judge of so many relatives and so many companions altogether, pronouncing judgment not about money, but about places of honor, as though he had invited them not to entertain them warmly, but to vex his own intimates. Menelaus, he said, was strange and proverbial enough, in that he offered advice though he was not asked for it. But stranger still is the man who makes himself, instead of a host, a judge and arbiter over people who neither submit their dispute to him nor are on trial, deciding who is better than whom or worse, for they have not entered a contest, but come to dinner. Nor, indeed, is such a judgment even easy to make, since some differ in age, others in influence, others in usefulness, and others in closeness of relation. Rather, one would have to keep at hand, as though rehearsing a comparative exercise, the commonplace arguments of Aristotle or the superlatives of Thrasymachus, accomplishing nothing useful, but transferring empty reputation mongering from the marketplace and the theaters into our drinking parties, trying to relax our other passions through good company, while stirring up this one by contrivance, a thing which I think much more properly belongs. It is far more fitting, I think, to come together easily and simply over wine, once we have washed off the soul rather than the mud from our feet. But as things stand, we try to remove whatever enmity has arisen among our guests from anger or business dealings, while by our concern for precedence we kindle and rekindle it all over again, humbling some and puffing up others. And yet, if more frequent toasts and further courses and still more conversation and greeting are to follow upon the order of reclining, our banquet will become altogether like a satrap's court instead of a gathering of friends. But if we are to preserve equality among the guests in other respects, why should we not begin precisely here and accustom ourselves, without pretension and simply, to recline together, seeing at once, from the doorway, that we have come to dinner as to a democracy, and not to some special preserve like a city, where the rich man, once placed at table, outranks the humblest guest in the order of reclining. When this too had been said, and those present demanded a verdict, I said that I had been chosen an arbiter, not a judge, and would take the middle course. Young men, I said, who are entertaining fellow citizens and intimates ought to be trained, as Timon says, to distribute themselves simply and without pretension into whatever place they happen upon, taking such easiness as a fine provision for friendship. But when we play the philosopher in the presence of strangers, officials, or older men, I am afraid we may seem to be shutting pretension out at the courtyard gate only to let it in again by the side door, with a great show of indifference. In this matter, something must be conceded to custom and to law as well. Or are we to do away with toasts and greetings too, the means by which, toward those we happen to meet, we show honor not indiscriminately, but as far as possible, with the seat and the meats and the fuller cups, as the King of the Greeks says, setting precedence in the place of highest honor. We also praise Alcinous, because he seats his guest beside himself, making his own son rise from his place, Laodamas, a man of loving heart, who used to sit nearest him and whom he loved best of all. For to seat a suppliant in the place of one's beloved is a graceful and humane act. Such discrimination exists even among the gods. Poseidon, though he arrives last at the assembly, takes his seat in the very middle, as though that place belonged to him by right. Athena, for her part, is shown always to hold the seat next to Zeus as her own special privilege, and the poet hints at this where he says of Thetis that she sat down beside Father Zeus, and Athena made way for her, while Pindar says outright that she sits nearest him who breathes fire like the thunderbolt. And yet Timon will say that one ought not take honor away from others by assigning it to one alone. But it is he, rather, who seems to do this. For the man who makes common what belongs to one in particular takes it away from him, and what belongs to a person in particular is what is owed to each according to his worth. And it is valor and effort that establish the prize of a race, just as birth, office, and the like establish their own claims. And the man who thinks he avoids being burdensome to his guests by treating them all alike, in fact, draws trouble down on himself all the more, since he causes pain by depriving each of the honor customary to him. To my mind, however, the business of discrimination is not so very difficult. In the first place, it is not easy for many people of rival standing to converge on a single invitation. And in the second place, once several places have come to be regarded as places of distinction, there is no lack of ways to distribute them if one can hit the mark. Telling one guest he has the first place, another that he has the middle, another that he sits beside the host himself, or beside some friend, intimate, or teacher, giving each of those called men of rank his due, while to the rest I would offer gifts and friendliness, which I think leave them more at ease than an honor would. But if the claims to precedence are hard to judge and the men themselves difficult, see what device I resort to. I seat in the place of greatest distinction, if a father is present, the father, taking him as my guide. If not, a grandfather, a father-in-law, a father's brother, or anyone else who has an acknowledged and particular claim to superior honor in the eyes of the host receiving him, taking this principle from the proprieties observed in Homer. For indeed, when Achilles saw Menelaus and Antilochus quarreling over the second prize in the chariot race, and, fearing they might go further still in anger and rivalry, wished to award the prize to someone else, professing, in word, pity and honor for Eumelus, but in fact removing the cause of their dispute. While I was saying such things, Lamprias, who was sitting off to one side as was his habit, spoke up loudly and asked those present whether they would allow him to reprove a judge who was talking nonsense. When everyone urged him to speak freely and spare me nothing, he said, "Who, indeed, would spare a philosopher who distributes birth, wealth, and office at a dinner as though it were a theater, or grants front seats as if by decree of some Amphictyonic council, so that not even over wine can we escape vanity? For reclining places ought to be arranged, not with a view to distinction, but to pleasure, and one ought not to weigh the worth of each individual by himself, but rather the relation and harmony of one person to another, as though various elements were being brought together into a single partnership. The builder does not set Attic stone or Laconian ahead of the foreign kind on account of its noble birth. The painter does not give the leading place to the most costly color. The shipwright does not put the pine of the isthmus or the cypress of Crete first. Rather, each thing is arranged so that, when combined and fitted with the rest, it will make the common work strong, beautiful, and useful. And you see that the god whom Pindar calls our master craftsman does not everywhere set fire above and earth below, but arranges them as the needs of bodies require. This, Empedocles says, is why among sea-roaming, heavy-shelled mussels, and stony-skinned whelks and tortoises, you will see the earthy part dwelling uppermost upon the flesh. Not the place nature would assign it, but the one that the arrangement suited to the common task requires it to occupy. Disorder, then, is a bad thing everywhere, but among human beings, especially when they are drinking, it shows its own vice most clearly, through insolence and countless other evils, which it is the part of a man skilled in order and harmony to foresee and guard against. We agreed that he was right to say this, and asked, "Why then do you begrudge us men skilled in order and harmony?" "There is no begrudging at all," he said, "so long as you are prepared to obey me as I rearrange and reorder the party, just as Epaminondas rearranged his phalanx." We all agreed to let him do so. He then ordered the slaves to clear the middle of the room and, looking each of us over, said, "Listen, since I am about to arrange you together, I want to explain beforehand. It seems to me that Pamenes of Thebes was not unjust in charging Homer with being inexperienced in matters of love, because he arranged tribe with tribe and mixed clan with clan, when he ought rather to have interposed lover among beloved, so that the phalanx might be of one spirit, held together throughout by a living bond. That is the kind of banquet I too wish to make of ours. I shall not place rich man next to rich, young next to young, official next to official, or friend next to friend. For such an arrangement is inert and idle when it comes to increasing and generating goodwill. Instead, fitting to each man's need what suits him, I direct that the lover of learning be placed next to the eager student, the difficult man next to the gentle one, the garrulous old man next to a young man fond of listening, the boaster next to the ironist, and the irritable man next to the man of few words. And if I happen to notice a rich man of generous disposition, I will bring to him, raising him up from some corner, a decent poor man, so that there may be an outflow, as it were, from a full cup into an empty one. A sophist I forbid to recline beside a sophist, and a poet beside a poet, for beggar envies beggar, and singer envies singer. Even though saucicles here and modestus, when they put their heads together in this way, strike sparks into flame and risk producing the finest results. Yet I separate men who are quarrelsome and abusive, and the quick-tempered, inserting some mild man between them, like a cushion against friction. Men fond of the gymnasium, of hunting, and of farming, however, I bring together. For of likenesses, one kind is combative, like that of fighting cocks, another mild, like that of jackdaws. I also bring drinkers together with one another, and lovers together, not only those who have felt the bite of a boy's love, as Sophocles says, but also those smitten with women and those smitten with unmarried girls. For warmed by the same fire, they will take to one another more readily, like iron being welded, unless, by heaven, they happen to be in love with the same person. From this, there arose an inquiry about the places themselves. For different peoples honor different places. Among the Persians, the seat in the very middle, where the king reclines, is the seat of honor. Among the Greeks, it is the first place. Among the Romans, it is the last place of the middle couch, which they call the consular place. While among some of the Greeks around the Pontus, such as the people of Heraclea, it is, on the contrary, the first place of the middle couch that holds this rank. But it was chiefly about the so-called consular place that we were most at a loss. For among us, this place held first rank in honor, and yet the reason for it was established as being neither that it was the first place nor that it was the middle one. Moreover, of the circumstances associated with it, some were not peculiar to this place alone, while others seemed to deserve no serious attention. Still, three of the explanations offered had some force. The first was that the consuls, having overthrown the kings and reorganized everything along more democratic lines, withdrew themselves from the central, kingly position and yielded to a lower one, so that not even this feature of their office and authority might weigh oppressively on their companions. The second was that, of the two couches assigned to the invited guests, the third couch, and the first place upon it, belongs above all to the host. For there, like a charioteer or a helmsman stationed on the right, he can reach out to oversee the service, and is not, in terms of the nearest places, cut off from showing kindness and conversing with those present. For the place just below him belongs to his wife or children, while the place just above him is fittingly given to whichever guest is held in the highest honor, so that he may be near the host. This place was thought to have a third peculiarity as well, its natural suitability for business. For the Roman consul is not like Archias, the Theban commander of the garrison, so that, if letters or messages requiring attention should reach him in the middle of dinner, he could simply remark, "Business in the morning," push the letter aside, and take up his drinking cup instead. No, he must be intent and watchful at just such moments. For it is not only true, as Aeschylus says, that night in travail brings forth cares for the wise helmsman. But every pleasure of drinking and relaxation likewise carries with it, for a general or magistrate, matters requiring attention. So that he may be able both to hear what he must and to give orders and instructions, he holds this particular place. For here, where the second couch joins the third, the angle formed by the bend leaves an opening that allows a secretary, an attendant, a bodyguard, or a messenger from the camp to approach, converse, and inquire, without troubling him or being troubled by any of his fellow diners, while he keeps his hand and voice free and unobstructed on the upper side. Craton, our son-in-law, and Theon, our companion, on one occasion when some unruliness had broken out at a drinking party and then subsided, raised the subject of the office of symposiarch, thinking that I, as the wearer of the garland, ought not to overlook a custom that had entirely fallen out of use, but should call it back and reestablish the traditional oversight and ordering of drinking parties under proper authority. This view was shared by the others as well, so that a clamor of encouragement arose from everyone. "Since then," I said, "this is the wish of all of you, I choose myself as your symposiarch, and I direct the rest of you to drink as you please for the present. But I ask Craton and Theon, as the proposers and lawgivers of this decree, to set out briefly, in some general outline, what sort of man ought to be chosen symposiarch, what goal the one chosen should keep in view in exercising his office, and how he should manage the affairs of the party. I leave it to them to divide the discussion between themselves." They made a show of reluctance at first, declining the task, But when everyone urged them to obey the ruler and do as they were told, Kraton spoke first, saying that just as the ruler of guardians ought, as Plato says, to be the most fit for guarding, so the ruler of drinkers ought to be the most fit for drinking. Such a man is one who is neither easily overcome by drunkenness nor unwilling to drink. Rather, as Cyrus said, writing to the Spartans, that he was more kingly than his brother in other respects, and also carried a great deal of unmixed wine well. For the man who misbehaves in his cups is insolent and unseemly, while the man who is altogether sober is disagreeable, and better suited to be a tutor than to preside over a drinking party. Pericles, for his part, whenever, having been elected general, he put on the military cloak, used to make a habit of addressing himself first, as though reminding himself, "Take care, Pericles, you rule free men, you rule Greeks, you rule Athenians." Let our symposiarch in the same way say to himself, "You rule friends," so that he may neither permit unseemliness nor take away enjoyment. The ruler over drinkers must also be at home with earnestness and no stranger to play, but blended well between the two, though tending, like a fine wine, a little more by nature toward the austere side. For wine itself will draw character toward moderation, softening and relaxing it. Just as Xenophon said that the grimness and rusticity of Clearchus, which elsewhere seemed unpleasant, appeared in battle pleasant and cheerful because of the confidence it inspired, so too a man who is not harsh by nature, but dignified and austere, becomes more agreeable and endearing once relaxed by drinking. Further still, he must possess, above all, an experienced knowledge of each of his fellow drinkers, what change wine produces in him, toward what disorder he is most liable to slip, and how he bears unmixed wine. For it is not merely that there is one mixture of wine with water for one man and another for another. A thing the king's own wine pourers know, now pouring more, now less. But there is also, for each man, a particular blending with wine peculiar to himself, which it is fitting for the symposiarch to know, and knowing it, to observe. So that, like a musician, tightening the string of drink for one and loosening and sparing it for another, he may bring their natures, out of difference, into evenness and harmony, taking care that equal shares are not measured out by the pint or the ladle, but that what is fitting and suitable to each is allotted according to some measure of occasion and bodily strength. And if this is difficult, the symposiarch ought certainly to know, at the very least, the general facts concerning natures and ages. For instance, that old men grow drunk more quickly than the young, and men who are already unsteady grow drunk faster than those still at rest. And a man who knows such things would preside over the good order and harmony of a symposium far better than one who does not. And indeed, that. The symposiarch must be on familiar and friendly terms with everyone, and be underhandedly hostile to none of the guests, is obvious to all. For he will be tolerable neither in giving orders, nor fair in distributing portions, nor blameless in his jesting with the company. "Such a ruler of the symposium," he said, "Theon, I have fashioned for you, as it were out of wax, and now hand him over to you from my discourse." And Theon said, "Well, I accept the man thus fashioned and fit for company, but whether I shall be able to use him in every respect and not disgrace the work, I do not know. It seems to me most fitting that such a man should keep our symposium orderly, and not allow it to become now a democratic assembly, now a sophist's lecture hall, then again a gambling den, and after that a stage and an actor's platform. Do you not see some men playing the demagogue and pleading cases over dinner, others rehearsing and reading aloud some composition of their own, others acting as judges of mimes and dancers? Alcibiades and Theodorus turned Politian's banquet into a mystery initiation, mimicking torch processions and hierophantic rites. None of this, I think, ought the ruler to countenance. Rather, he will give room, in speech and spectacle and games alike, only to what serves the true end of a symposium, and that end was to work an intensification of friendship, or its birth, through pleasure, among those present. For a symposium is a passing of time over wine that ends in friendship by way of charm. But since excess is everywhere cloying and unmixed wine is in many cases harmful, while a blending of things, when it comes about at the right time and with due measure, removes the too much by which pleasant things are spoiled and beneficial things made painful. Clearly, the president will provide the drinkers with a blended kind of pastime as well. Hearing many people say that a coastal walk is a sea voyage, and a coastal sail the pleasantest of journeys, he will in the same way mix play with seriousness, so that those at play may somehow keep hold of something serious, and in turn those being serious may take heart again, like seasick men gazing from close by toward the land of play. For it is possible to use laughter for many beneficial ends, and to make seriousness pleasant, just as among sea hedgehog plants and rough, risthero the flowers of soft gillyflowers grow. But whatever forms of play come reveling into symposia without any serious purpose, these he will carefully urge his fellow drinkers to guard against, lest unnoticed, like men who have taken henbane, they run wild into insolence and licentiousness under the guise of so-called commands, ordering stammerers to sing, or bald men to have their hair combed, or the lame to hop on one leg. So it was with Agapester the academic, who had a thin, wasted leg. His fellow drinkers, mocking him, ordered everyone to stand on the right foot and drain the cup, or else pay a forfeit. But when the turn to give orders came round to him, he bade everyone drink just as they would see him drink. Then, a narrow jar being brought, he set his weak leg into it and drained the cup, while all the others, finding it impossible when they tried, paid the forfeit. Agapester then was charming, and one ought to make retaliations of this easy and cheerful kind. And indeed one should grow accustomed to giving commands aimed at pleasure and benefit, ordering things that are fitting and possible, and that adorn the one performing them, bidding singers to sing, orators to speak, philosophers to resolve some difficulty, poets to recite some verses. For each person is led gladly and eagerly to that in which he happens to be at his best. Now the king of the Assyrians proclaimed by herald a prize for whoever should discover a new pleasure. But the king of a symposium might well set forth a fine prize and honor for the one who introduces play free of insolence and beneficial delight, and laughter that is companion not to mockery and insolence, but to charm and kindliness, since it is on this point that most symposia founder, for want of proper guidance. It belongs to a temperate man to guard against enmity and anger, the kind that arises in the marketplace from greed, in gymnasia and wrestling schools from rivalry, in offices and honors from love of glory, and at dinner and over wine from play. How is it that it is said? Love, too, teaches a man poetry, even one unmusical before. This question was raised at Sosius's house, when some verses of Sappho had been sung, since Philoxenus too says that even the Cyclops healed his love with tuneful muses. It was said, then, that love is a formidable force in bringing men to every kind of daring and innovation, just as Plato too called him bold and an undertaker of everything. For he makes the silent talkative and the shy attentive, the careless and lazy diligent and industrious. And what one might marvel at most, a stingy and petty man, once he has fallen into love, is softened as iron is by fire, becoming gentle and pliant and sweeter, so that the jest does not seem altogether absurd, that the purse of lovers is tied with a leek leaf. It was also said that being in love resembles being drunk, for it makes men warm and cheerful and expansive, and once they are in this state, they are borne along especially toward song and metrical speech. They say that Aeschylus composed his tragedies while drinking and growing warm with wine. And Lamprias, our grandfather, was, when drinking, most inventive and most eloquent of himself. He used to say that, like frankincense, he gave off vapor under the effect of heat. And indeed men who take the greatest pleasure in seeing their beloved take no less pleasure in praising them than in seeing them. And love, talkative about everything, is most talkative of all in praise. For lovers are themselves persuaded, and wish everyone to be persuaded, that they love people who are noble and good. This is what drove the Lydian Candaules to bring in a spectator into the bedroom to view his own wife, for lovers do not wish to be believed on their own testimony alone. That is also why, when writing praises of the beautiful, they adorn them with melodies and meters and songs, as though gilding statues, so that they may be heard by more people and remembered. For even if they give a horse or a cock, or anything else to their beloved, they want the gift itself to be beautiful and conspicuously and extravagantly adorned. Above all, in bringing flattering speech, they wish to appear pleasant and splendid and extraordinary, of the sort a poet is. Sosius, however, having praised what had been said, remarked that one could do no worse than to take as a starting point what Theophrastus has said about music. Indeed, he said, I recently read the book. Theophrastus says that there are three origins of music, grief, pleasure, and inspired possession, each of these turning the voice aside from its accustomed course and inclining it. For griefs have a tendency to slide into the mournful and lamenting strain of song. That is why we see orators in their perorations and actors in their lamentations, gently approaching melody and stretching out the voice. Again, intense joys of the soul in those lighter of temperament lift up the whole body as well and summon it to rhythmic movement, as they leap and clap their hands if they cannot dance. Frenzies and cries of those roused, with head thrown back in tumult, as Pindar says. But more refined people, when in this state of feeling, let loose only the voice into singing and the uttering of measures and melodies. Most of all, inspired possession drives both body and voice out of their accustomed and settled course. Hence, Bacchic rites employ rhythms, and prophesying in oracular verse comes to those possessed by the god. And of madmen, one can see few who babble without meter and song. Since this is so, if you wish to look closely, unfolding love to the light, and examine it, you would find no other passion possessing sharper griefs, or more violent joys, or greater ecstasies and derangements. Rather, just as one can see in Sophocles a city, at once full of incense smoke, and at once of paeans and groans, so too is the soul of a man in love. It is, then, nothing strange or wonderful if love, containing and comprising within himself all the origins there are of music, grief, pleasure, inspired possession, is in other respects too fond of speech and talkative, and more than any other passion, inclined and prone toward the making of songs and verses. There was talk about King Alexander, to the effect that he did not drink much but spent much time over wine, conversing with his friends. Philinus showed that those who said this were talking nonsense, from the royal journals, in which it is written most frequently and repeatedly that on this day he slept off the drinking, and sometimes the following day too. That is why he was also rather sluggish in sexual matters, but quick and spirited, which are marks of bodily heat. It is also said that his skin gave off a most pleasant fragrance, so that it filled his tunics with a spicy sweetness, which too seems to be a mark of heat. For that reason, the driest and hottest regions of the inhabited world produce cassia and frankincense. For Theophrastus says that fragrance arises through a kind of concoction of moisture, when the harmful moisture is drawn off by heat. Callisthenes too seems to have fallen into disfavor with him because he was reluctant to dine on account of the drinking, since, when the so-called great cup of Alexander was passed to him, he pushed it away, saying that he did not wish, by drinking of Alexander's cup, to need the help of Asclepius. So much, then, for Alexander's heavy drinking. As for Mithridates, who made war on the Romans, they say that in the contests he held he set prizes for gluttony and for heavy drinking, and that he himself won both, and altogether drank more than any man of his time, which is why he was also surnamed Dionysus. We ourselves said that this was one of the things believed at random, namely the explanation given for the surname. For when he was an infant, a thunderbolt burned his swaddling clothes but did not touch his body, except that a trace of the fire remained on his forehead, hidden beneath his hair, while he was still a child. And again, when he was already a man, a thunderbolt fell into his bedroom while he slept, and though it fell upon him, his quiver, hanging beside him, was pierced through, and its arrows set ablaze. The seers, then, declared that he would have the greatest strength from archery and light-armed troops, but most people called him Dionysus after the thunderbolts, on account of the resemblance of the event. From this, there was talk about men who drank a great deal. Among these they reckoned also the boxer Heracles, whom the Alexandrians affectionately called Heracles, who lived in the time of our fathers. This man, when at a loss for a drinking companion to stay with him, used to invite some for the morning drink, others for lunch, others still for dinner, and last of all some for the revel afterward. And as the first group departed, the second would join in, then in turn the third and the fourth, and he, without any interruption, held out for all of them and carried through all four bouts of drinking together. Among those who lived with Drusus, son of Tiberius Caesar, the physician who used to urge everyone on in their drinking was caught taking 5 or 6 bitter almonds beforehand each time, so as not to get drunk. And when he was prevented from this and watched, he could not hold out even a little while. Now some thought that almonds have a certain biting and cleansing quality upon the flesh, such that they even remove freckles from the face. And so, when taken beforehand, by their bitterness they scour the pores and produce an irritation, by which they draw down the moisture evaporating from the head. To us, however, it seemed rather that the power of bitterness is a drying one, one that consumes moisture. That is why, to the taste, of all the flavors the bitter is the most unpleasant, for the little vessels of the tongue, being soft and moist, as Plato says, are strained unnaturally by the power of dryness, as the moisture is drawn out of them. And bitter drugs are also used to dry up wounds, as the poet says. And upon it he laid a bitter root, rubbing it with his hands, a pain-killing root which held off all pains, the wound dried and the blood ceased. For he rightly called bitter to the taste that which has a drying power. And it is evident, too, that the powders athletes use, with which they wipe away their sweat, are bitter to the taste and astringent, their bitterness coming from the intensity of their tartness. So then, I said, since this is so, it is reasonable that the bitterness of almonds helps against unmixed wine, by drying the inner parts of the body and not allowing the veins to become filled, since it is by their distension and disturbance, they say, that drunkenness comes about. A strong proof of this argument is what happens with foxes. If, after eating bitter almonds, they do not also drink water afterward, they die, as their moisture is suddenly drained away all at once. The question was raised concerning old men, why they take more pleasure in stronger, less diluted drink. Now those who suppose that their condition, being chilled and hard to warm, was for that reason suited to the intensity of a strong mixture, seem to be saying something common and ready at hand, but not sufficient for the cause, nor even true. For the same thing has happened in the case of the other senses as well. Old men are hard to move and hard to affect in their perception of qualities, unless these strike them in a concentrated and forceful way. And the cause is the slackness of their condition, for when relaxed and weakened, it tends to need a hard blow to be struck. That is why, in taste, they welcome above all pungent flavors, and their sense of smell has undergone something similar with respect to odors. For it is stirred more pleasantly by strong, undiluted sense. Touch, on the other hand, is unresponsive to wounds, for sometimes, when they receive injuries, they feel scarcely any pain. Very similar is the case of hearing. Musicians, as they grow old, tune their instruments sharper and harder, as if rousing the organ of perception by the blow of an intense sound. For what tempering is to iron for sharpness, breath provides to the body for sense perception. And when this slackens and relaxes, the organ of perception is left sluggish and earthy, needing something forceful to prick it, such as unmixed wine is. While we were casting about for arguments on the matter before us, it seemed that the case of sight ran counter to this. For older people read letters by holding them far from their eyes and cannot read them close up. And indicating this, Aeschylus says of someone that not even from close by, for it is not clearer from nearby. And Sophocles indicates the same thing about old men still more plainly. For a heavy blow in speech scarcely makes its way through the pierced ear, but though he sees far off, close up he is altogether blind. If, then, the senses of old men respond more readily to intensity and forcefulness, how is it that in reading they cannot bear the illumination reflected from close by, but rather, by drawing the book farther away, do they weaken its brightness with the air, just as wine is diluted with water? Now there were some who said, in reply to this, that people do not draw books away from their eyes so as to make the light softer, but rather so as to gather in and take hold of more radiance, filling with bright air the space between the eyes and the letters. Others, however, held with those who say the rays combine. For since a cone extends from each of the two eyes, having its apex at the eye and its base and seat encompassing the object seen, it is likely that up to a certain point each of the cones travels separately. But once they have gone farther off and fallen in with one another, they make a single light. That is why each of the things seen appears as one and not two, even though it appears to both eyes at once. The cause is the joining of the cones into the same point and their coalescence, which produces one vision out of two. This being so, old men who bring the letters close, before the rays have yet mingled, but still touch the object separately with each ray, grasp it more feebly. Whereas those who set it farther off, once the light has already been mixed and has become abundant, grasp it more precisely. Just as those who hold something with both hands together succeed where they cannot with one hand alone. My brother Lamprias had not read Hieronymus's clever remark, that we see by means of the images that fall upon our sight from visible objects, and that these images set out large and coarse-grained at first. That is why they disturb old men at close range, since their vision is slow-moving and hard. But once the images have been carried into the air and have acquired some interval of travel, the earthy parts break off and fall away, while the fine parts, drawing near the eyes, fit smoothly and evenly into the passages, so that the old men, being less disturbed, perceive more clearly. The same is true of the scents of flowers, which strike us more fragrantly from a distance. But if you bring them too close, they do not smell as pure or unmixed. The reason is that much of what is earthy and turbid is carried along with the scent and spoils its fragrance when it is taken in from close by. But from farther off, the turbid and earthy part flows around and falls away, while the pure and warm element in it, owing to its fineness, is preserved for the sense. We, however, holding to the Platonic principle, said that the ray-like breath issuing from the eyes is mixed with the light surrounding bodies and forms with it a single compound, so that one body arises out of both, sympathetic through and through. One is blended with the other according to a ratio of proportion and quantity. For it is not necessary that one be destroyed by being overpowered by the other, but rather that a single power be produced from both, brought together from a midpoint by harmony and communion. Since then the stream from the eyes of the elderly, whether one should call it a current flowing through the pupil, or a breath, or a light-like ray, is weak and feeble. No blending occurs between it and the external light, nor mixture, but rather destruction and overwhelming, unless they draw the letters far from their eyes and so relax the excessive brightness of the light, so that what meets the sight is not abundant and unmixed, but of like nature and proportionate to it. This, indeed, is also the cause of the condition of animals that feed by night. For their sight, being feeble, is overwhelmed and mastered by the light of day, unable to blend from so weak and slight a source with a light so great and strong. But toward the dim and faint light, such as that of a star, it sends out a ray sufficient and proportionate, so that the sense can share and cooperate with it. Theon the grammarian, when we were dining at the house of Mestrius Florus, raised a puzzle to Themistocles the Stoic. Why is it that Chrysippus, though he mentions many paradoxical and strange things, such as that salt fish becomes sweeter if soaked in brine, and that the locks of wool yield less to those who tear them apart by force than to those who work them apart gently, and that people who have fasted eat more slowly than those who have eaten beforehand, gave the cause of none of them? Themistocles replied that Chrysippus proposed these merely as examples, in an offhand way, since we are easily and unreasonably taken in by what is plausible, and then again disbelieve what runs contrary to the plausible. And turning to Theon, he said, "But you, my excellent friend, why trouble yourself over these matters? If you have become a seeker and observer of causes for us, do not camp so far from your own concerns, but tell us for what reason Homer, in the river, and not in the sea, though it was near, has Nausicaa doing her washing, even though seawater is presumably warmer, more translucent, and better for cleansing." Theon said, "But that difficulty Aristotle resolved long ago, the very one you have set before us. For seawater has earthy and rough matter dispersed through it, and this mixed in matter produces its saltiness. And it is for this reason that the sea more readily buoys up swimmers and supports heavy weights, since fresh water, being pure and unmixed, yields more because of its lightness and weakness. Hence, owing to its fineness, fresh water penetrates and passes through and dissolves stains more than seawater does. Or does this not seem to you a plausible account from Aristotle?" "Plausible," I said, "but not true. For I observe that people often thicken water with ash and stones, or, if these are not at hand, with dust, on the ground that earthy matter by its coarseness is better able to wash away dirt, while water itself, owing to its fineness and weakness, cannot do this as effectively. So the coarse matter of the sea is never fit for washing, but rather for its pungency. For this pungency, by opening and unstopping the pores, carries off the dirt. But since everything oily is hard to wash out and leaves a stain, and the sea is oily, this would rather be the reason why it does not wash well. That the sea is indeed oily, Aristotle himself has said. For salt contains an oily element, and salt water makes lamps burn better. Moreover, the sea itself, when sprinkled on flames, blazes up together with them, and of all waters, seawater burns most readily. And this, I think, is also why it is the warmest. Not only that, but in another way too. Since the goal of washing is drying, and what becomes driest appears cleanest, the liquid that does the washing must depart quickly along with the dirt, just as hellebore must depart quickly along with the disease. Now fresh water the sun draws off easily, owing to its lightness, whereas salt water, being caught in the pores because of its roughness, is hard to dry. Theon took this up and said, "That is nothing to the point, for Aristotle in that same book says that those who bathe in the sea dry off faster than those who use fresh water if they stand in the sun." "So he does say," I replied, "but I should have thought you would rather trust Homer, who says the opposite. For Odysseus, after the shipwreck, meets Nausicaa looking dreadful, befouled with brine, and says to her attendant maidens, 'Stand off there apart, that I myself may wash the brine from my shoulders.' And going down into the river, he wiped from his head the crust of salt, the poet having marvelously observed what actually happens. For when men come up out of the sea and stand in the sun, the heat disperses the finest and lightest part of the moisture, while the salty and rough part is left behind and settles and remains upon their bodies as a salty crust, until they wash it off with fresh, sweet water." At Serapion's victory celebration, when he had trained the chorus for the tribe of Leontes and won, we were dining as fellow tribesmen by adoption, and talk arose naturally about the eager rivalry that had taken place. For the contest had been an intensely fought one, since Philopappus the prince had presided splendidly and magnificently, sponsoring all the tribes together. He happened to be dining with us, and out of kindness as much as love of learning, was both telling and hearing old stories in turn. A question of the following sort was then put forward by Marcus the grammarian. He said that Nennius of Cyzicus reports, among the local legends, that the tribe of Aeantes had the privilege that its chorus was never judged last. Whether he said this to establish it historically, or whether it is not spurious, let the inquiry into the reason be set before everyone in common. When our companion Milon said, "But what if the story is false?" Philopappus replied, "There is nothing terrible in that," he said, "if we suffer the same thing as the wise Democritus did, out of love of learning. For he too, it seems, tasting a cucumber and finding its flavor honey sweet, asked the serving woman where it had been bought. And when she told him it was from a certain garden, he told her to get up and lead him there and show him the place. When the woman, astonished, asked what he wanted, he said, 'I must find the cause of its sweetness, and I shall find it by seeing the place for myself.' 'Then just sit down,' the woman said, smiling, 'for I, not realizing it, put the cucumber into a jar that had honey in it.' And he, as though vexed, said, 'You have spoiled it, but nonetheless I shall pursue the inquiry no less, and I shall seek the cause, on the assumption that the sweetness belongs to the cucumber by its own nature and kinship. So let us not, either in some cases, make an easy excuse for evasion out of Nene's claim, for the discussion will provide useful exercise, if nothing else.' So everyone flowed together evenly toward praising the tribe, gathering up whatever fine thing contributed to its reputation. For Marathon too was brought into the discussion, being a deme of that tribe, and they pointed out that the men around Harmodius were of the Aeantes tribe, being in fact from the deme of Aphidne. And Glaucias, the orator, maintained that the right wing at the Battle of Marathon had been assigned to the men of Aeantes, relying for proof on Aeschylus's elegiac verses at the border shrine, since Aeschylus had fought conspicuously in that battle. And he further pointed out that Callimachus the polemarch was also from that tribe, a man who both proved himself the best man, and after Milchiades, was most responsible for the victory in that battle, having cast his vote in agreement with him. I added to what Glaucias had said, that the decree by which the Athenians were led out was written while the tribe of Aeantes held the presidency, and that in the Battle of Plataea that tribe distinguished itself above all. for which reason the men of Aeantes conducted the victory sacrifice, prescribed by the oracle at Delphi, to the Esphragitic nymphs at Cithaeron, the city furnishing them the victim and everything else. But you see, I said, that many such honors belong to the other tribes as well, and you know that my own tribe, Leontes, yields to none in reputation. Consider, however, whether it is not more plausible that the story is a consolation drawn from the tribe's eponymous hero, and that what actually happens is an excuse. For Telamonian Ajax is not one to bear defeat easily, but one who, in anger and contentiousness, would spare nothing. So, in order that he might not become harsh and inconsolable, it was thought fit to remove the harshest part of defeat by never placing his tribe in the very last position. Among the things prepared for dinners and drinking parties, my dear Saucius Senecio, some have a necessary order, such as the wine, the food, the delicacies, the couches, and of course the tables. But other elements have arisen for the sake of pleasure, without being strictly required, such as musical performances, spectacles, and a certain jester, Philip, from the household of Callias, things that please those present, but that people do not particularly miss when absent, nor do they complain that the gathering was lacking on their account. In just the same way, among topics of conversation, the moderate sort of people take up some for the sake of usefulness at their drinking parties, while they receive others as an agreeable form of entertainment, more suited to the occasion than the flute and the lyre. Of these, our first book already contained mixed examples. Of the former kind, the discussion on philosophizing over wine, and on whether the host himself should assign or leave to the diners the arrangement of the couches and similar matters. Of the latter kind, the discussion on whether lovers are given to poetry, and the discussion on the tribe of Aeantes. I call the latter kind, then, table talk proper, and the others, in a general sense, symposium questions. They have been written down at random and not in any orderly division, but just as each came to memory. Readers should not be surprised if, in addressing you, we have brought together some of the very topics you yourself proposed to us beforehand. For even if learning does not consist in acts of recollection, still, remembering often amounts to the same thing as learning. Each book has been arranged into 10 problems apiece, and in this book the first is one that, in a certain way, Xenophon the Socratic has set before us. For he says that Gobryas, dining together with Cyrus, admired many things about the Persians, and in particular that they asked one another the sort of questions that were more pleasant to be asked than not, and joked about the sort of things it was better to be teased about than not. For if others, by praising us, often distress and vex us, how could one not admire their wit and good sense, whose very jests brought pleasure and charm to those being teased? So then, when you were entertaining us at Patri, you said you would gladly learn what kind such questions were, and what their proper form is. For it is no small part, you said, of the art of social intercourse, this science and observance of tactful questioning and playfulness. A great part indeed, I said, but consider how Xenophon himself, both in the Socratic banquet and in the Persian ones, displays this type. If it seems good to us also to take up some account of it, I think first, that people are glad to be asked what they can easily answer. And these are matters in which they have experience. For those who are ignorant, or who, if they do answer, are troubled, as if asked to give something they cannot give, or if they do answer, they are disturbed and put at risk by speaking from mere opinion and unreliable conjecture. But if the answer is not only easy, but also out of the ordinary, it is more pleasant for the one answering. And answers are out of the ordinary when they belong to people who know things that most do not know or have not heard, such as matters of astronomy or logic, provided they have real command of them. For each person, not only in acting and passing his days, as Euripides says, but also in conversing, is put in the best humor when he happens to be at his own best. And people delight in being asked the very things they know, not wishing to remain unknown or unnoticed for knowing them. That is why those who have wandered and sailed widely are more gladly asked about a colonial land and a foreign sea, and about barbarian customs and laws, and they gladly relate these things. And sketch out bays and coastlines, thinking that this too brings them some pleasure and consolation for their toils. In general, whatever we are accustomed to relate and tell of our own accord, though no one asks, Is it not sweeter to be asked, since we think we are doing a favor to those who ask? Yet it was really the business of those who grow tired of it to refrain from asking further. This kind of affliction, indeed, grows especially among seafaring men, but more refined people like to be asked about the following things. Things which, though wishing to tell them, they feel shame about and hold back out of consideration for those present, such as whatever they themselves happen to have accomplished and achieved successfully. Nestor, at any rate, rightly understood Odysseus's love of honor when he said, "Come, tell me, Odysseus of many wiles, great glory of the Achaeans, how did you two take these horses?" For people are annoyed at those who praise themselves and recount their own good fortunes, unless someone else present bids them do it, and they speak as if compelled. They are gladly asked, at any rate, about embassies and public affairs, if they happen to have accomplished something great and splendid. Hence the envious and malicious are least willing to ask about such things, and if someone else does ask about them, they deflect and turn the conversation aside, refusing to give room to the narration and unwilling to offer the speaker occasions for a discourse that would do him credit. These things, then, by asking about them, do a favor to those who answer, things which they perceive their enemies and ill-wishers are unwilling to hear. Indeed, Odysseus says to Alcinous, "Your heart has been moved to ask about my grievous sorrows, so that I may grieve and groan yet more." And Oedipus says to the chorus, "It is a terrible thing, stranger, to stir up an evil that has long lain quiet." But Euripides says the opposite, that it is sweet to remember hardships, though not for those who are still wandering and suffering evils. One must therefore be cautious about the questions one asks concerning misfortunes. For people are pained when they must relate their own convictions in court, or the burials of their children, or unsuccessful ventures of some kind by land, or unlucky business ventures by sea. But how they fared well on the speaker's platform, or were addressed with honor by the king, or how, when others fell into storms or fell among bandits, they themselves escaped the danger, of such things they are gladly asked, often, and in a way, enjoying the matter afresh through the telling, they are insatiable in narrating and recalling it. They also enjoy being asked about friends who are prospering, and about children advancing in their studies, or in advocacy, or in friendships with kings. But about the reproaches, injuries, and convictions of enemies and ill-wishers who have been exposed and brought down, they are more pleased to be asked, and report them more eagerly themselves, while they hesitate to volunteer such things on their own, guarding against a reputation for malicious pleasure.